Recording? Yes, it is. And it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, Alex Simmons, how are you? We're in the middle of the summer. Chris yep. Ryan, Alex Simmons.
Looking sharp, too. What? Aren't we looking sharp?
We got the sharp teeth.
Yep.
Sharp-dressed men right here. We're dressed for the summer. It's the end, towards the end of July, and we're having some summer fun and getting into some summer trouble. I am a hybrid author of traditional and self-published material. Alex Simmons is a legendary author. author of stories featuring Scooby-Doo and Batman and, oh man, so many different people. It's redonkulous. Including, of course, the 1930s Soldier of Fortune, Aaron Blackjack Day.
Yeah.
Alex and I aren't sitting back on our laurels saying, look at the wonderfulness of us. No. Last episode.
In our last thrilling episode.
That's right. And if you didn't see last episode, pause right here and go back, because that silliness really caused this silliness today. Alex got his followers and audiences on various...
Our followers and audience.
Excuse my face. Excuse my face. Our followers on social media to suggest like three words that we're supposed to utilize and write a story based on some of those suggestions or one of those suggestions.
Yeah, and, be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, because we said okie doke and we went off and wrote, and today is the fruits of that labor.
That's right.
Our audience flees for the hills. One or the other.
Fruits, yeah.
But right. Alex and I have done what you commanded, audience, and we have selected some words from the list that you provided, and we have created stories based on those. So we're going to talk about those, right, Alex?
And let me just piggyback off of that and say that the whole reason for this wasn't that we didn't have anything else to do with our time. The reason for this was to help show how writers, how creatives can be inspired by prompts. And when I don't mean AI prompts, another use for that word, which is a word or a thought or an image or phrase or something that inspires or sparks an idea, a little fleeting bit of a story or plot or character, and how you can riff on that and build on that to create whatever it is, a story, a song, an article, whatever. So this was us putting our skills where our mouths are, and talking about this sort of thing and different techniques for over 268 episodes.
That's right.
Number 269.
We're always talking about where you get inspiration, right? And exactly. Sometimes I just follow Glorious around and
Glorious being his lovely wife, by the way. So.
And see whatever.
Someone doesn't know that.
Yeah, everybody should know that by now. If not, demerit. And then whatever's out there, if you play what if with it, it can become stories and that kind of thing. And this was another form of that. All right. So, what do you have to say? Right. Now, before we start, just to keep you, now that you're all, I'm excited. What did they do? We're going to slow down. And I'm going to ask Alex Simmons, hey, man, what's up? What you been doing?
Yeah, that's funny. You should ask. Hint, hint, nod, nod, wink, wink. I've been actually working on a couple of things. One, it's the, as Chris said a little while ago, it's July. It's the end of July. And so the summer semester at the New York Film Academy is coming to a close in another couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my screenwriting students are prepping, trying to finish that last bit on their script or their treatments and get ready, because they have to turn those suckers in for their grades, but also because a number of them also have to prep to actually film their short films.
There you go.
So there's a lot of work involved, and that drive, that focus over the next few weeks. And I got to be there to help guide them in so they have a smooth landing. So that's been that. And then the other thing is working on writing a couple more afterwards. That's that sort of after statement in a novel or a book. In this case, for the Asterix graphic novel series that's being published in English here in the United States. So I get to take some of that wonderfulness that Uderzo and Goscinny created with those wonderful characters and the satirical stories, and also put them in context because they were created and written and drawn during the 1960s. And there are a lot of interesting things within there that I get to shine a light on and comment on and, again, bring into context. So that's part of what I've been working on the past few weeks.
Cool.
Chris.
Yes, sir.
Chris, what have you been up to, sir? Yeah.
I'll give you two things very quickly because people want to hear these stories. First of all, I have been prepping the second volume of Soul Scream Anthologine. There's the first one. Really?
Yeah, well, he's talking to the bookshelf now.
I don't know where the
Christmas he's looking for something, is. Folks. That's for all of you listening to the podcast or rather watching it.
I must have brought it up to the other room. But there's the Christmas one, which is volume zero. And then there's this one. And Dark Justice will be the second full volume. And I think I'll finish the editing on that today. And then tomorrow will be all layout and off we go to the races. There will be.
Let me just quickly say, for those of you who are going, wow, what is he up to? What Chris has been a man on a mission with this project for almost a year. And I want you to go back and listen to some of our selected episodes between roughly like episode 250 and here.
Yeah.
You'll get bits and pieces of the story and some insight into not only being a publisher, an indie publisher, but also being an indie editor and a number of other hats that the magnificentness of Mr. Ryan wears.
Since you said bits and pieces, I'll tell you that we have teased that Anthologine, Soul Scream Anthologine, is part anthology, part magazine. But now I can tease one other level.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Read together from the Christmas one all through the four official volumes.
Is there a special surprise?
There's a novella or novel type story woven throughout all of them.
Oh.
Check that out. So my playing with
formatting. You bon vivant. You special kind of guy. Wow.
My playing with platform and genre and format continues. And we'll see what it goes. Some people might love it. Some people might hate it.
Yeah, but we'll take care of those.
If you like the more straightforward stuff, this came out this last weekend. It just came to my house this week.
Now, we were supposed to talk about that a little because we had juiced up everybody for our readings, and we were going to talk about that in the break. But okay.
Oh, well, let's talk about it now, get it out of the way, because once the readings start, then there'll be parades and statues. And
oh, really?
So this is Six Gun Legends. This is 10 rounds of Wild West action. They are new legends of the Old West, edited by our friends Jim Beard and John C. Bruning of Flinch Books. We have interviewed here on before. I have The Outlaw Noir in Blazing Guns, Rolling Death. And
I'm sorry, say that again.
Blazing Guns, Rolling Death. And The Outlaw Noir, I was really thrilled to be able to be part of creating that, or to create that for this, to be part of this book. And we are scheduled to have Jim and John on again in August. So hopefully we'll get to talk about this and a few other things. And there you go. Pretty exciting.
Sounds wunderbar. Okay. Now, as we said before, because of the prop exercise that we did in 268, here in 269 is the result. And just to be so super special, we're going to start with Chris. Yes.
Oh, I'm so nervous. All right.
No, go ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, last week, and if you're watching this on YouTube, you'll be able to see it. But if you're listening on podcast, I'm going to hold up the notes I took during. Yes.
What a mess. All hand scribbled, by the way.
Hey, listen. I was a lefty raised in Catholic schools during the 60s when they said, if you're a lefty and you write with a left slant, that means, of course, that you're the devil. I write like this so I could have a righty slant.
Oh,
so
my
I'm not the devil.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow.
Okay. But in any case, I want to read the list. Now, not all of these are on, so I'm going to try and skip the ones I didn't use. Okay? But I had asked for Black Duffel Bag, Bad Haircut, Pensive, Food is Love. You should have that. You should have a jar of these, man.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Infected, Swelling Unnaturally, thicker than water. It won't open. Unholy tangled mess. Disturbing loud sound. And chocolate ice cream soda. Those were of the list of the notes that I took. Those were ones that I was able to use.
Just again for folks, those were words that were suggested by a number of people on social media for us, like sometimes one word, sometimes two or three words, right? Little phrases. Yeah. They suggested this whole list, and then we grabbed a few from that list to be inspired by.
Okay. Yeah, for example, Tom Schnadowski there, he wrote infected, swelling unnaturally, and thicker than water. Okay, because clearly nothing disturbing about him.
Who's off in San Diego and just did a panel on some bizarre horror subject. I forget what it was.
Ah, that's cool. Yeah, that's very cool.
He's at the San Diego Comic-Con sharing his warped mind, but that's great because he'll be here in a few weeks sharing more of his warped mind.
That's great.
Yes, I'm eager. I got my popcorn. I'm ready.
So here we go, and let me get this set up.
It's Chris Ryan about
Okay, so this is called McTavish. Night fishing. Aiden struggled to suck the chocolate ice cream soda through a metal straw he had borrowed from his mother's kitchen. Not the same experience as sitting across from Greta at Brain Freeze, but here we are. Food is love. And Greta loved chocolate ice cream sodas, so he bought them every time he came to visit. Got them from the BF, as she liked to call it. Put them in a small cooler. Packed them in ice from mother's fridge so they wouldn't melt or spill. He owed Greta that much. Besides, a cooler was easier to put in the rowboat. The first time he tried to surprise her with ice cream sodas, he attempted to hold the two cups between his feet as he rowed. Disaster. But she understood. Thought it was funny, actually. That made everything okay. Greta made everything okay. And now she always would. Forever. McTavish could sense the feelings wafting off Aiden from way over on the shoreline. Across the street from Lake's Edge, truth be told, where he was studying an impromptu memorial the locals created. Flowers, notes, small crosses, and pictures of young Greta. All of it pulsed with loss. Over decades serving this weird calling, he had rarely experienced such unified communal heartbreak. Their shared pain brought him here. The whole town was in mourning over one young innocent. Almost the whole town. McTavish turned toward the silhouette of the lone figure sitting in a rowboat in the middle of a lake at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. He felt Aiden's joy, his misguided love, his twisted triumph. A big fella. Maybe he played high school football, now gone to seed a bit. Or perhaps it was years of playing Madden and other video games. Didn't make a difference what his story was, though, did it? The town needed help. Deserved closure. McTavish sighed, stared over at this one dissonant soul for a moment longer. He'd been at this a long time now. Never got any easier. Here we go, he murmured, rolling his shoulders with a scrape and a hollow knock that tended to creep others out. Luckily, no one else was around to hear it or see him as he walked out towards what looked to be a 16-foot rowing dory. The boat didn't bother him. The passenger in it? Tavish had never been pulled to a location for a party. So yeah, bother pretty much summed it up. Aiden focused on Greta, sharing her favorite treat. Chatting, spending time together, until they heard the unthinkable. A pattern of soft splashes that sounded like walking. He excused himself, turned towards the shore, and felt his heart clench in fear. A man strolled towards them across the water. Aiden stared as the figure drew closer. Eventually, he could make out details. Black boots, jeans, a faded old army jacket, hands hidden in the front pouch of a black pullover hoodie, a beat-up baseball cap with an American flag patch sewed on the front. The walker was looking down, so Aiden couldn't see his face. But how was this guy not sinking? Were there rocks just below the surface? Was he hallucinating? When the guy was less than 20 feet away, Aiden couldn't help himself. How are you? The American flag rose to its full glory as the guy looked up. Every part of Aiden jumped. The guy had no face. Under the hat was just a skull. It raised one skeletal finger to non-existent lips. Shh. Aiden dropped his drink. The top popped off, spilling chocolate ice cream soda across the flat bottom and keelson. The skull shook from side to side. You should have those in jars, man. Aiden wet his pants. Ah, I get that a lot. The fully clothed skeleton climbed into the boat and sat opposite the chubby, terrified young man's skull. Bony finger tapped a name patch above the old man's left breast pocket, the old jacket's left breast pocket. McTavish will do fine, thanks. The skull, Aiden's eyes dilated as shock spread. A hand of bones passed in front of the skull, replacing it with a human face. Hair, eyes, nose, mouth, teeth, lips, and even normal hands were all just suddenly there. None of them were memorable. McTavish asked, "Better?" Aiden's relief was palpable. "Yes." The ordinary face melted away, leaving just the skull. "Too bad," McTavish said. "The townspeople in mourning, they see the boring guy. You get me." "Why?" Tavish tilted his head, empty sockets studying the young man's pale face, vacant stare, bad haircut. He leaned forward closer. The kid went from pensive to 5 o'clock, five alarm freakout, scrambling backwards, almost propelling himself out of the boat. A wave of a skeleton fingers, and all that reversed. And Aiden found himself sitting again, just inches away from the skull in the American flag hat. The aged jaw moved slightly as McTavish announced, "Aiden, we gotta talk, buddy."
"I didn't do anything."
"You did. That's why I'm here." His gravelly voice sounded like it was inside Aiden's brain. "You and me, we gotta make this right." Aiden suddenly dared some attitude. "Why am I any of your business?" McTavish moved his skull in a way that made him seem like he grinned. "Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." He watched Aiden blink. "Nothing? Really? I tell you, the education system in this country has really slid into the crapper."
I don't understand."
"That kid is obvious." McTavish leaned over, glanced in the direction Aiden had been facing when he still held his ice cream soda. There was a tiny bobbing marker floating in the water there. "This so you know where she is? Where you put her?"
I don't have any idea what you... She just liked the lake.
You loved her or something. Wanted her all for yourself, even though she was so much younger than you. McTavish pointed his index finger bones at the guy, knowing that unnerved people. Pedophile?
No, never. She was an innocent child.
The tone, expression in the eye, even the heartbeat aligned with truth, McTavish noted with relief. The locals will be glad when they eventually learn that from a coroner. Then why, Greta? Aiden shook his head furiously.
I would never hurt the girl. She was the only one who ever told me I was great at making her ice cream sodas.
So you kidnapped her, brought her out here, and stashed her at the bottom of the lake? Aiden, that's no way to acknowledge kindness.
I did not hurt her.
I beg to differ. McTavish extended both arms down toward the water and swung them up. The little Marco flew out of the lake, trailed by a thin fishing line, and finally, with an upward splash as it broke the surface, a black duffel bag. It hovered at their eye level, the weight of it a bit lower, water gushing through the material. From Aiden's dismayed shock, he thought it was waterproof. No way to treat a friend, McTavish admonished.
That's not mine. Aiden leaned away from the black duffel bag. She's not in there.
Let's see.
It won't open. See, the zipper's all mucked up.
McTavish moved his skull from facing the floating duffel bag to the boat. The bag moved forward, lowering itself between them, despite the spilled ice cream soda. The unnerving presence nodded his chin at the bag. From inside the soaked canvas came a disturbing, loud sound, like a desperate gasp after being unable to breathe for a long time. Aiden shook. There was movement from within the bag. Aiden cried out. Something black and slimy push itself through the small opening where the muck-covered zipper ended. A finger, the nail cracked, infected, wormed its way out of the bag. The digit was unnaturally swollen, oozing a viscous liquid thicker than water, blacker than blood. As the zipper surrendered to its efforts, a second joined in. Then a third, a fourth, a second hand. Both were small, violated, disturbing. The bag opened. An unholy tangled mess of hair emerged, dripping more of that foul goo. Things moving beneath the once beautiful curls. Aiden lost the power of speech, emitting only baleful bleats now. Greta emerged, sitting up, torso out of the duffel bag. She tilted her horribly ruined face up to Aiden. Why? He tried to look away. McTavish flicked a finger from Aiden to Greta, and the murderer's head snapped forward, eyes forcibly opened. Answer her. She deserves that much at least. Struggling mightily, Aiden found he couldn't move, couldn't avert his eyes, couldn't escape the deathly stench he had condemned her to.
You were nice, always. I didn't know how good that could feel. Once I experienced it, I wanted more. Thought that if I had worked hard enough, I'd get it from other customers, my boss, teachers, my family. But it only ever came from you. Only you. I had to keep that safe. I couldn't risk the darkness of others ruining you.
Greta studied him with her dead eyes. You did.
No. I saved you. Kept you from this brutal life.
Greta seemed to sink into herself a bit, as if saddened by the pathetic truth of her demise. By stealing mine. Aiden flew into a rage. You, Boneface! You're putting words into her mouth. You ruined her beauty, her innocence, my memories. Greta shook her head slowly. He's not here for me, Barry. The killer deflated. My name is Aiden. The lifeless shell of the girl raised and dropped her shoulders. Does it matter now? And with that, she was gone. Her corpse slid partially back into the bag, but the head remained visible, staring its truth at her murderer. McTavish rowed them back to shore and the waiting squad cars. Police surrounded the rowboat, some with guns drawn. The sergeant addressed the nondescript stranger, easing the oars into the tiny vessel. You, McTavish, the private investigator? McTavish tapped his name patch. Thanks for coming. He needs help. She needs a proper burial. You'll stay and make a statement? Sure. McTavish waited by one of the squad cars until a crowd of neighbors formed. Can't keep anything secret in small towns. Not forever, anyways. Amid the cries and anguish and the relief of knowing of closure, he slipped away. Job done. Maybe he'd be able to have a bourbon with a friend before he was needed elsewhere. There you go. I think you're muted, bro.
No, I'm not.
Oh, there you are.
I was clapping.
Yeah, I couldn't hear the clap, though.
Oh, you couldn't?
No.
That's interesting.
That's okay. I saw it. Still can't hear the clap.
Wow, that is interesting.
I'm
clapping here, folks.
I'm Freddie Prince.
I'm clapping here.
There you go. I'm clapping here. I'm clapping here.
Yeah. Wow.
There you go. What do you think?
Wow, 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 wow.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay, folks, it's been a great episode. I ain't going after that. How did you do it, Chris?
Yeah, well,
what was the process?
The process was as follows. I was on deadline to finish up Soul Scream Anthology Volume 2 when you came up with this challenge. And I was like, oh, man, do I have time to do both? And a little voice in my head said, you can if they're the same assignment.
Mm.
While I was looking there, I started thinking of, can any of these words help me with McTavish's story? I knew he was going to. I knew the bones of the story. And sorry with the pun.
Yeah, I know you're not.
I actually had told Glorious the rough of this story, and I recorded it into my phone while we were walking around a wet reservoir with our dog, the alleged security officer for Seamus Nunzio Publications here at Productions. And poor Glorious has to deal with this all the time. I'll say, what do you think about this? And then go off with some madness. And then when I said I was going to write Night Fishing, I said, this is going to be so easy. I'm just going to open up what I recorded. I'll translate it or transcribe it. And when I transcribed it, it was madness. Because the transcription really couldn't understand my Bronx accent. And I was speaking like excited as the story was coming to me. So it was just madness. So I had to abandon that and start from scratch.
What do you use for transcription? I'm sorry,
I just happen to have my phone with me. So I have a recorder on the phone. Do you remember when I used to go to the cons and just talk to strangers?
So you didn't mean
the same thing.
You didn't record an audio and then pop that into your computer to be transcribed. You were talking into your phone and it was typing.
No, then I hit the transcription button after that. But so it transcribed into madness. It was just, gotcha. Okay. It was hilarious. Yeah, it was really funny. I knew the bones of it, but I had to write it from scratch. And when you were doing last episode, issuing the challenge, and we were both reading people's suggestions, there was a competition between McTavish and another character I have named Penelope, who was a very petite, very lethal adolescent, raised in the world of hitmen and strong-armed people and that kind of stuff. That's a story for another day. But McTavish won out. And I think what did it was Black Duffel Bag. And then when Tom's suggestions came, I knew where they would fit. And then things started happening there. When I forget who suggested chocolate ice cream soda.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look.
That became, what could I do with that? I said, it's twisted if he's bringing her favorite treat to her out in the middle of a lake where he has submerged her so no one can find her.
Mm.
And I had to make him, I made him a little heavier so we could believe that he would sit there and drink both of them, pretending she had one herself while he spoke with her. And it just would allow me to layer it, quietly layer the madness of this character. And then I decided what year he was born. And I went to popular names for boys. And I said, let me see the one that I immediately dislike the most. And it was Aiden. So there's a way to name characters. And then the other things, I really loved, you should have a jar of these, man. I had to change that line a little bit. You should have that in a jar, man. I hope that I did it justice. And so I was able to play with the challenge and also meet my deadline.
Excellent.
It's a great exercise. It's an exercise that goes all the way back to my grad school days when I was first writing City of Woe, which is soon going to be relaunched, but we'll talk about that in another episode. I was taking creative writing classes, and in my mind, I was going to do everything I could to whatever assignment we got, turn it somehow into a chapter of City of Woe. So that's kind of, so I got used to thinking, how can these apply? And the exercise is getting to yes. So often we say, oh, that won't work. That won't work. No. And you don't, what that does is it stops the creativity. How could it work? Is more open.
Yeah.
And you can allow yourself to have some fun with the creativity. Now, this all hinges.
I say, how can I play with this? How can I? Yeah.
It all hinges on whether people enjoy the story. Because if they were just like, wow, this is just horrible crap that just every once in a while throws a word in, then I should be shining shoes for a living. But if people liked it at all, if it worked as a story, it might need a little polishing or whatever, but the assignment was to get a story in, then it's proof of concept. And if I can do it, anybody can do it.
So you just said something, so I want to go back to that polish. Was this a first draft, rough draft, a second draft? What? How much?
Okay, if we count me telling Gloria as I walked as a very first rough draft, right? And then transcription, when I saw the gibberish, I had to retell myself the story. So that's second draft, right? This would be first written draft, but third draft of the story, because I'm telling myself it again. However, Joyce Carol Oates style, I have seen the movie of the story in my head while I'm either vacuuming or walking the dog or whatever. And I believe in that. I think there was a bit of genius that she shared with everybody when she said she works on stories when she's running. She's 85 now. She's in the Sunday New York Times magazine today. So God bless her. 85, another book coming out. That's a badass mama right there.
There you go.
But she always said that she would run and tell herself or watch the story in her brain. And if she hit a glitch, she would work that out as she was running. And she would keep doing that process until she could run and see the whole story beginning to end without glitches. And only then would she write it. I would consider those drafts. So you're always working, even when you're not working, right? You're having fun with it. So after the challenge, when I wrote it, then I got it down quickly. And then next day, I went to a fourth draft. The first draft is to just
get it done, get it out on a screen, or if you write longhand, right? There it is. And then the next draft.
That was a puke, folks, just for you.
Get it right out there. Yeah. And then the next draft is, which would be our fourth draft, would be to make that coherent. Not to be great yet, but to make it coherent. So you'd taken all the distracting typos and, whoa, you forgot these words or whatever, and you get that in. And then there's another one where I read it out loud, and the things that I stumble on, I try and smooth out a little bit. Mm. And then there are one or two other readings to see if it actually worked. And then this morning, before the episode, I burdened Glorious's quiet time. Can I read this to you? It's the second time I've read it to her. So if you count each one as a draft, I probably went through the story 10 times.
Gotcha.
But actual writing, probably 4 times. And while I was doing this reading, I noticed 2 or 3 places where I had still had little typos and whatever. It has to go through one more time, probably as I'm putting it in. I'll be doing layout on Monday. So that's probably when.
So we're going to thank, I'll go back through the list, or we'll go back through the list and find the people who contributed those words. And we'll let them know how wonderful they were in terms of being a part of inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to figure out what we can
do. Some way of saying thank you.
Yeah. I had some ideas last week. We'll have to figure out what makes most sense. I realized I didn't write anyone's names down, so I'm at the mercy of,
like I said,
hopefully you still have it.
Luckily, the submissions, if you will, were done on Facebook. So they're still there. They're still there waiting for us to go back. And
well, hopefully, if people are kind enough or incensed enough, either way will work. they'll put some comments down in the comments section below here and let us know
what they
how thought. That one worked and how the legends work, because we're about to turn our attention to the legend.
Oh, geez. Behave. Okay, so here we go.
So you saw the rookie. You saw the guy who he throws breadcrumbs to. So he allows to be here studying at his feet. But ladies and gentlemen, this is the moment you've all been waiting for.
Yeah, so you get to see me in spandex.
And listen, let me tell you, it's a sight.
Yes, it's a sight. My eyes! Okay. One of the things that was fun about this whole exercise for me, including when I came up with it, was because there are so many different ways that writers approach the process, the creative battlefield that we run across, or the field that we run across, that allows us to go from nothing, a blank screen or blank sheet of paper, to a finished, published, whatever. And I've often taught my students, and I know you have too, Chris, that it's about what's in here. It's about the story you want to tell and how you want to tell it. Who are you as a writer? How you approach things? And I often say to them, look, I'll teach you some methodologies and some techniques, but it's like going to a hardware store. You pick up tools that you need, and the other tools you leave. It's about what methodologies work for you. So one of the things I wanted to do was, with this process, with this little exercise, was to see how Chris was going to approach what he did, and how I would approach what I do, and just as demonstrations, not as who is taking a smarter course or less work or whatever. It's really about different ways that we go at what we do. And I
was no wrong answer.
Exactly. So I will say that I think it's great and perfect that Chris did what he did, including all of the editing and smoothing out of certain things. And then including, as you said, even after doing this reading, you notice a couple of things that you want to fine tune. That's perfect, because as we've said 1,000 times on the show, literally let it suck the first time. And then as you go back, the blessing is in the rewriting and in forming of telling the story to yourself first, and then forming it into the story you want to tell to everybody else. So in my case, yes, in my case, I took, you're about to see Raw, because what
hey
I
now, hey, this is a family yeah, show.
It's a family show. I know. Okay, cover your eyes, avert your eyes. Okay, what I did was I took the words that I was curious about, or shall we say tickled me or inspired me or whatever, and I selected, let me just refer back to the short list that I had. I grabbed from the selections that people gave us, I grabbed Yellow Fog Rising, Bow-Legged Sue, Unholy Tangled Mess, which Chris did a brilliant job with, Yellow Taxi, My Own Reflection, Fork Tender, Hula Hoop, and Ominous Ship. So I did not know what I was going to do with any of these words. You just jot them down because something about them scratches at you. And you say, okay, let me just grab those words. And then I had a very busy few days of working on totally other things, some of which we talked about at the top of the show. And then I sat down and I said, okay, now I'm going to go and I'm going to look at that list of words again, and I'm going to see what springs forth. What says take a leap with this? And I didn't know if I was going to try and put all the words into the event or what. This was really just spontaneous combustion. So what I did was I looked at the list of words. One of them finally went, yes. And I said, okay. And I did what...
Oh, this is going to be a thrill.
Yes, hang on here. Here we go. I did what I refer to as my mind map. Now, for those of you who are seeing this on YouTube, because I use that silly little fake backdrop thing, every now and then the sheet fades out. But this is my mind map. This, I'm holding up a sheet of paper, which if I get it angled just right, it will appear. it's a little bit...
Ghosts.
There we go. Okay. So this is just a scramble of words on a sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper. And what I did was I took the phrase that sparked the thought, popped it down there, and then just let whatever came to my mind splatter onto that sheet of paper. Just a cacophony of fragmented words and phrases, and yet all of them sparked by the one phrase I had pulled from my list. And then once I saw that, I took a step back for a moment. This is still all within the same sitting. I took a step back for a moment. I looked again at the page after a few minutes. Certain words began to almost float towards me. I let them roll around in my head, and then I went to Google Doc, popped up the text to speak to text microphone so that you can transcribe directly onto the Google Doc, and wrote the story that unfolded in my head. I would even call it the scene that unfolded in my head. And I wrote it just stream of consciousness until it said the end in my head. And then I went back and I read it and corrected some gibberish, because you're right, certain transcriptional technology gives you gibberish. You know, I don't have that. I think it's Dragon. I don't have Dragon. I'm going to have to try that one of these days. But working with Google Doc, God bless you, Google Doc. Thank you very much. You've saved my buns on several occasions. But this one was, what the heck did I say here? So I went through that, cleaned it up. And what you're about to hear now, this short scene, is stream of consciousness with a little bit of a tweaking. Okay. So all of the buildup from the Padawan to the master. No, we're not reversing this, because what Chris read was masterful. And what I'm going to read is going to be, in effect, a first rough draft of a scene inspired by one of these words. It's called, I'll remember Whitey, you know, Captain Whitey. His real name was Whiting or something like that. But hell, what were we going to call him, this white man leading a troop of colored men all through France? And he wasn't too happy about it either. You got to understand that the colored man was not welcome in that man's army. Now, as far as the United States was concerned, we could have kept out of it completely. Hell, in the beginning, they figured they didn't even need us. And when they first needed us, when they finally needed us, for the same thing, they figured, yeah, we'll just keep them doing the same thing they've always done. To pick things up, carry things around, dig holes, and clean up behind somebody. Damn, they didn't even let us have guns at first. I remember the sky was so blue, almost like where I was born. Oh no, I wasn't born in New York City. I was living there when I got drafted. I was born in North Carolina, where my family is from, in a small little town on the southwest coast near the water. You never heard of it. Most people never heard of it. It's about 2 hours from Raleigh. I don't even think folks in Raleigh even ever heard of it. But as I was saying, the sky was blue. I remember that. And the hills and the groves of trees were like dark green. I remember thinking the grass was bright green and felt soft. It made you just want to lay down and roll in it. I remember the people. When we marched through the villages and the towns, most of those French folks would line up and stare. They'd never seen a colored man before. For months, they would look at us like we came from outer space or something. And they'd be whispering and staring. Not like the folks down south or even in New York. No, you know, when they stare at us like, you don't belong here and please don't touch me kind of thing. These folks were more like curious. I guess we were strange to them. Imagine growing up your whole life and never seeing anyone whose skin is darker than your own. But we were wearing the same uniforms as the white soldiers, so they must have just figured we were all Americans. And we weren't going to tell them anything different. I remember the shops, the houses, and little cottages. They were painted white and brown and a few other colors. And I'm thinking, these people have a little pride in showing off where they lived. There were even windows with flowers in front of them, with reds and pinks, and there was all the fruits that people had brought, some of them that they grew. I remember passing, as we marched from one area to another, and I remember passing rivers with clear water. That was light blue. Sometimes you could just look through it and see the bottom. Or maybe there was places where there was a little bit of grassy moss, and that was green, like light green. I can remember that real well. I remember the battles we were in. The sounds of the guns going off, the bullets flying around, and you couldn't protect yourself because you don't have a weapon, and we didn't have any weapons. Sometimes we'd be, I don't know what, for weeks on end, moving along the coastline, coming out every now and then, being in an open field or a little valley or seeing a small town somewhere beyond. But we couldn't go into it because Jerry was there waiting for us. And by the time we were allowed to carry rifles, we'd seen a lot of ugly things. I remember seeing so many soldiers shot up behind there and the brown earth. The funny green uniforms we were wearing, I guess they call it khaki. Yeah, dark green and dark brown stains on it. And them white boys, boy, they could bleed. You could see it against the contrast of their skin because it was lighter. We were shot. We were bleeding. We bleed longer. Because the medics weren't always fast in getting to us. Few of us knew how to treat wounds and things, do the best we could. I remember thinking, I better take all this in because this may be the last thing I ever see. The fighting was getting closer and it was personal, like almost like back on the street in the city, you know, with knives and things. But here it was different. We were digging in the trenches and Jerry would be just like maybe 50 yards away and would poke up and shoot at you. Or sometimes they'd shoot and the shooting gets so intense, people come charging out of the trenches and going at each other with bayonets and rifles and knives and pistols and things. It's a funny thing. By 1918, the Germans were losing. The French, the English, the Americans were beating their tails into the ground. Everybody was bad off then. So the skirmish lines, they were weaving and zigzagging back and forth all over the place. It's hard to tell who was really out there on the battlefield. It's hard to tell who was really winning. Most of the time, we were all out of supplies, not just weapons and bullets and grenades and things like that. We were out of food. We'd fight and cut off their supplies, and then they'd fight and cut off our supplies, and we get further in, push them back, and then they come at us, and none of us were in any shape to be doing any of this. I remember looking at some scraps of food that we'd put together this one time. Can't really tell you much about what it was. Some of it was some stuff that the soldiers had found in the woods, vegetables or something. Some had killed a rabbit or two every now and then and cut it up and share it. We were mostly in small groups, they call them squads. A few of us black soldiers with one or two French soldiers. I can't remember what that stuff really looked like. It smelled funny, but you had to eat it. Starve to death or not have the strength to fight. And if you couldn't fight, you'd die. I remember that last day, though. It was funny. The sky wasn't as blue, more gray. Yeah, gray. It was early morning. Everything was damp. And we were thinking, we can't do much more of this because we're running out of time and strength. Got to be coming close. You just have to hang in there a little longer. Deal with this chill a little bit more. But the chill was cutting through our uniforms, what was left of them. We ain't seen the enemy for a while, several days. And suddenly I remember thinking how the grass looked funny. It wasn't green anymore. It wasn't dark or light. It was dingy looking. I thought it must be the early morning mist blurring things out. I remember thinking that, yeah, I saw the blurry green light, green grass. Some of the other men saw it, but we're thinking, maybe we're tired. Maybe that's what's doing this. And then the color became, I don't know, clearer. I remember it was yellow. Yeah, that was the color. Grass seemed yellow, but it wasn't. It was like the yellow was a mist, like smoke or like fog on the water in the early morning, but there was no water. It was just dirt and grass and trees. But that yellow fog was rising. It was swirling around us. Some of us trying to cover our mouths or our nose with our hands or our shirts. We did the best we could, but we started coughing and backing up a bit. We didn't want to drop our guard because we figured the enemy was somewhere off there just ahead of us, you know, ready to shoot us or charge us. The moment we were blinded by this smoke or something, figured we wouldn't see them rushing us. So we're trying to squint through all this smoke, trying to keep our guns ready. Some of us finally started shooting ahead, not at anything in particular, just trying to keep ourselves safe somehow. And I couldn't see anybody. We couldn't see anything. And finally, we had to back up. We had to keep backing up further and further. And I took some water from my canteen and spread it on a rag and put it over my eyes and my mouth so I could try and breathe through it. But I was already coughing. We were sure any moment the Germans would come rushing at us, but they didn't. We waited for an hour or so, waited for the wind to clear the fog away, and we advanced, but we were still coughing and wheezing. Eyes were still stinging a bit. We figured we'd find them at some point, and it'd be a firefight, and we'd end up dead or alive. But we didn't find them. I guess that's a good thing, because in the hours as they rolled by, the burning and the stinging increased. Some of our eyes, we could barely see, and as blisters and sores started appearing on our skin. A few of us were having trouble breathing. We can still feel it. In fact, 2 days later, some of us were covered in blisters. And some of us who had trouble breathing didn't make it at all. They said I was one of the lucky ones. I'm laughing now. I said, see, I was one of the lucky ones. You can see that, right? But I'm still having trouble myself, especially since I can't see anything anymore. That's it. I see what you're saying. I didn't hear the clapping either.
Strange, right? Yeah, it doesn't pick it up. That's very weird.
Oh, that is strange. Folks, we've just learned something about technology here today.
When it started to dawn on me what direction you might be taking, because I knew yellow fog on the water, Tina's grandfather and my own grandfather, or my great-grandfather, her grandfather. He, as a very young man, was in World War One. Uh-huh. And my great-grandfather was in World War One. And I never met my great-grandfather, but they would talk about mustard gas.
Mustard gas, yeah.
Scars and stains and all, and how people would come out blind or lung seared.
Lung damaged, yeah.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff. I knew what was coming, but didn't. So it was a weird effect in that your characters are going through and they're seeing the greens and the reds and the blues. And that became ominous to me because I knew while they're in war and they were black people in war way early, way before. I don't know that we ever got to the level we should be honoring people who are fighting for us, no matter who or what they look like or who they are. But definitely during World War One and even World War Two, it was amazing that they even wanted to serve at all because of how they were treated. But here they were, and it was an interesting dread that I experienced as you were going through the most common things. I was turning like, any minute now, it's coming. And that was a great effect.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. As I said, the process for me was interesting because I didn't know until I knew what I was going to do with what was in front of me. It's very much improvisational in a way. If I were talking theater or acting, to take a prompt, a cue, any little bit, any little word, and to see where it takes you, and to then understand after how you got there. Because some of the last couple of years, I had worked on a project that involved World War One, and it wasn't about black soldiers in that time, but I certainly made sure I mentioned them in the project.
Sure.
And Yellow Fog on the Water initially was Yellow Fog on the Water, and then Yellow Fog, smoke, mist, gas. Oh. And then what was the story? What was the story? And I didn't know that as I turned on the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing that came to mind was white. Okay, we're going to play with color. And then how do I start with white, whitey, whiting? Okay. And then it just began to roll from there. And the more into the moment I got, the faster it rolled. And I think that it would have been different had I tried to write it as a third-person narrative. I think it would have been harder. I don't know that, but I think so, because the story came to me so strongly because I got into first-person mindset and I had to be the character who experienced this. And then it was telling my story. And so I lived it. So what do I recall? And so it was, again, how you let your mind roll free, or as we've said, how you play with the possibilities and the pieces. It's not about, how am I going to write this thing? How am I going to make this work? It's, what can I do with this?
Right,
where is it going to take me?
And again,
just one more thing, just not to judge anything. Had I said, oh, that's probably not going to work, or this is probably, oh, that's probably dumb, or I've already done a thing about World War One. If I'd done any of that, I would have gotten in my own way. I would have tripped myself up. I would have stopped the process, and I'd been standing there going, humming, humming, humming. So it's, again, about roll with it. Once you get it out there, if it works, and if it doesn't, fine, roll with something else, or start to manipulate it to clean it up and help it to be better.
And even the characterization of the narrator. Once you start realizing this is really a story that's set in military setting, there is a school of thought that says there should be more military jargon, but not from this guy, right? He's not embraced by the military. He's not cared for by the military. He's in the back of the line. He's the cleanup guy. He's not even given guns. He's not even given the respect to the military. So the omission of military jargon and know-how underscores that racism and becomes another layer of reality for that story, you know? Except for Captain Whitey. Yeah, Captain Whitey. We never get anyone's names. And never miss it. That's fascinating, isn't it? And we never get to know this guy except that he has a skin tone darker than Captain Whitey, but we don't get down into exactly how dark he is, and we get a little idea of where he's from, but it's just, those are just broad strokes, and there's a real winning innocence and wide-eyedness about him for most of the story.
That was another thing I wanted to try and do too, because for the world we live in now, I find, for instance, when I talk to younger people than us, there's a naturalness about knowing what the rest of the world looks like. Either they've seen it on the big or small screen, read the news or seen the news, or they've traveled. Another part of the planet is not that bizarre, right? But in 1918, in particular, general population hardly traveled, but right. Blacks in particular barely made it from down south to the north. Let alone know what any other country, including Africa, look like. So for him, what he got out of the army was the clothing on his back and a ticket to another place where people were going to try and kill him. You know, and yeah, he could approach this experience totally from, F you, I don't want to be here, I'm going to run when I get a chance or whatever. But there was a certain amount of, look where I am. And look at all this stuff that I never even thought about, except for familiar things, trees, grass, hills, water, that sort of thing. I'm familiar with that, but everything else is new, different.
And the other thing that really works is that he sees everything. He doesn't so much talk to us about how things taste or how they smell or how they feel to the touch. But he sees everything, and it plays into his innocence and his wide-eyed and his openness to the world. But it's also, it was one of those things, at the very last line, everything flips. All those wonderful things we watched him see or saw with him become foreshadowing. We lose everything that he gained in that journey. He was thinking that how long he'd be around. He wasn't thinking, he doesn't know how long he'd be able to see.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a really efficient way to utilize description without throwing up the red flag or pointing, hey, I'm foreshadowing, making it very organic. And paying it off with the final twist. Ladies and gentlemen, pay attention to what this man does.
I'm going to play one more moment here, and I won't put you through the whole thing, but I just want to show again the multiverse of creativity.
All right.
Where Chris went with his story, where I went with mine, those are two wonderful pathways, timelines that you can play along, but there are other multiverses. And so one of the other phrases that I had grabbed from that list inspired this. And as I said, this was also as impromptu, a matter of moments, right? I just went, okay, where's this taking me? And click. And again, it's another thing about approaching from the point of view of a character, because sometimes it just makes the storytelling easier. Mm-hmm. And this is also an example of another type of storytelling.
Right. Now, did you tell us the word that?
No, you'll know the word in a moment. Right. You'll know it in a moment.
All right, here we go.
Okay, here we go now. You ready for this now, folks?
I'm apologizing
early for some of what you're about to experience. This is a ballad that's really quite new. A story of a young girl named Bow-Legged Sue. Was back as a boy in the years that I grew, that I first got smacked by Bow-Legged Sue. Bow-Legged Sue, Bow-Legged Sue, the men who have wronged you are really quite few. And I was one, because I didn't have a clue that we all deserve someone, even Bow-Legged Sue. There was Tommy O'Flynn, who saw her in mood. She knocked him so hard, he never came to. And Clarence Coltrane poked fun at her, too. Now he walks in with a limp, and his dentures need glue. Oh, Bow-Legged Sue, the men who have wronged you are really quite few. And I was one, because I didn't have a clue that we all deserve someone, even Bow-Legged Sue. Last verse here. The other night, I was watching the news. They had a story about Bow-Legged Sue and the business she built and the jet that she flew and the family who loved her and the joy that she knew. And then you fill in with the refrain again. Bow-Legged
there
Sue.
There you go. Very nicely done. That's great. Bow-Legged Sue could have been used very detrimentally, and to go and fly in the face of that and have her stand up, that was cool.
Yeah.
I like the last verse too, where she's a bigger success.
Because you can't call it.
We're
fools to be judgmental that way.
That's true.
Yeah.
Nicely so done.
It's been quite a show.
This has definitely been a show, and we hope that you got something out of it. Maybe hopefully a little, oh man, I'm just going to open myself up and see what happens and get on with my writing. Because that's really what all of Tell a Damn Story is about, is to help you keep going. If something interested you, or if you have a question about the writing, or if you have a comment about the writing, we'd love, absolutely love to see some comments down below. This is something that we're beginning to enjoy. We've gotten a few so far, and we're looking for more. We don't want to be selfish, but we want the community. We're building community. You already helped us with the suggestions, and we hope that you like the results. And now let's hear from you.
By the way, we will find the folks, identify the folks that we plucked some of these inspirations from, and thank you very much for that. And then find some other way of saying thank you on a slightly larger scale. Don't know what that is yet, but we'll figure something out because we're cool like that.
Let's buy them an island. Wait a minute. Let's tone that down a little.
Yeah. Maybe buy them an island record, but
we'll figure it out. We'll let you know in a future episode.
Oh, I know. We'll give them a recording of Bow-Legged. No. Okay, folks, thank you very much. As Chris said, please leave your comments, suggestions, and questions in the comment section. Chris, always a pleasure.